Hi, and welcome to a new episode of Cinema Nation, a new podcast brought to you by The Media Machine. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I am Ben Gertz in beautiful, rainy, cold Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, and I'm in sunny Los Angeles. Sorry, the weather's always nice here.
Always perfect and always the same.
It's rained 7 times since I've been here in August, from August to now. So
I don't know if we could be on more polar precipitation. I have an app on my phone purely called, I think it's just called Is It Raining or something like that. Like its sole purpose is to alert you. I don't really use it, but it's supposed to alert you.
If it is raining.
Yeah, when it's going to rain. Like it'll send you an alert that says it's going to rain in 15 minutes. And I'm like, well, this app is useless in Portland because it's pretty much raining in the non-summer beauty. Like all the postcards are in the summer, basically. You know, it's just been raining a lot. But anyway, that's super dark. Let's talk about freedom, Brandon.
Yeah, let's talk about freedom. So the first topic on our list is The Interview and the Sony hack that happened this past December. When did it start? Was it in November or was it just in December? I think it was in November.
The actual hack?
The hack started.
Not to get into the weeds of the technical, but like there's a lot of conflicting information. But some of the researchers have said that the hackers would have been that may have had access to Sony's system for as long as several years, because one theory is that it was basically an inside job with someone who was on who had been on staff as a security or IT person, and only once they had kind of gathered all the things they wanted to gather did they finally try and blackmail them for money. So
interesting. Now, but I didn't know.
I think the news went public in November, maybe late November.
The question: do you think it was North Korea? I know the U.S. says it was, but
yeah, I mean the New York Times I think has been reporting with other groups, and there's a guy. I think his name is Brian Krebs on security.
Yeah.
I could be really butchering that, but he's kind of the go-to freelance security hack expert, and he's been one of the outspoken people. I haven't checked in lately, actually, but he was one of the people initially saying that it was not North Korea, and they were casting doubt on the FBI report. The most compelling thing that I've read is basically saying that, like, the initial demands from the hackers were just for money.
Yeah.
And they were just in poorly written English, but they had nothing to do with the interview as a film at all. They just wanted money so they didn't leak data. And then at some point the story was, you know, kind of picked up by the media, and then this whole question of like, well, is it related to the interview? Is it because of the interview? Is it North Korea? Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden the messages from the hackers fell in line with that, you know, that they were basically like, we are the
Guardians
the people's
of peace.
Defender. Yeah, Guardians of Peace. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, we have a friend. He was like, I think it was all planned. I think it was all planned by Sony. He's like, I think it all was. He's like, now I think the hack really happened. I think he said this. I'm surprised if you're listening to this. I'm sorry if I'm getting you wrong. He was like, I think the hack happened, but I think Sony just capitalized on the hack and decided to stir up stuff to get the interview released and see if they can get people there.
I think the counter argument to that is although that's very appealing, I've heard a lot of people kind of say like, man, if they did this intentionally, they are so genius. But I think I think all the leaked emails that have kind of, you know.
Yeah, I don't think.
I guess the saying is that it, you know, a lot of egg was on people's faces, you know, like a lot of people were embarrassed by a lot of the things that were leaked. And you have to think that will have long-term sort of business, petty potentially, but long-term personal, problems for some of these executives or directors or people who said really terrible things about other people, you know?
Yep.
So that's the thing that makes me pretty certain it's not the promotion of it all, the managing the whole crisis of it all, they were either so genius to drag it out for so long or just so inept. I could not decide the entire time, like, Because, like, one of the first things when they said, when they announced that, you know, well, there were threats about the theaters, right, showing it. So they were like, well, we'll give them the option to show it. And then theaters say, well, we don't want it. So then that was their way of bailing out. And then, of course, like, within, like, the same day, you know, The Verge and several of these tech websites were like, stream it online, make it available, give it away, sell it, do anything. And it was just so obvious that that was, like, an option.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's like they were like, well, there's just no one who will take it. And, like, the president got involved. The president of the United States got involved. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it was just like either they are so, like, slow playing this and we just don't even, like, it's just hard to figure out. But it really captured a lot of people's attention, you know. And, like, by the time it finally came out, I mean, this is the real breaking news of the story, Brandon, for all of our listeners. Is that I have seen this film, and you, sir, have not. Is that an accurate depiction of the facts?
Yeah, that's an accurate depiction of the fact.
This is the reason I'm gloating is because this is very rare, and you reminded me of how rare this is in the pre-show. So I think we watched it. We got it on the Google Play Store, which was the first time I'd ever, you know, rented on the Google Play Store, but we got it for like $6 a couple days after it came out. And it is actually a really, you know, it's a funny film. Like it's so interesting. I think you might've said this during the whole thing. I don't remember. We were texting maybe, but you know, it's so interesting that a film because it does kind of balance these like somewhat interesting ideas in the film. It's not just ridiculous James Franco jokes. It's actually like it's got some deep, you know, some really funny moments in it beyond frat humor. But it's so interesting that in 20 years or 10 years or whatever, when we talk about like this shift away from theater, you know, the window of exclusivity for theaters and this day and date release, you know, which is what they did. This is like the first really large film with a big budget that's been day and date. And like, it's so interesting that this is going to be the film that we look back on. And they haven't, I haven't seen all of the official numbers yet because they keep the streaming numbers really, you know, close as far as the exact breakdown. But you know, basically they've come out, you know, better or about the same as if they put it out in all those theaters.
Like, yeah, it says, there's an interview on Deadline. It says, that according to some people, that the interview had made $31 million in film rentals and sales from December 24th to January 4th.
And obviously, you know, there's so much, like, so many asterisks you have to put on some of this stuff of, like, you know, they had exceptional awareness of the film, right? Because the president of the United States was issuing press releases about it. And, you know, it was all over the news. And so, you know, I think it was one of the writers on The Verge was saying, you know, like, even his grandmother was aware of the film. You know, like, people who were never going to see the film were aware of the film.
Yeah, that was, I remember around that time, anywhere I went and I said I was in film school or whatever, people were like, what do you think of the stuff with the interview in Sony? Like, every single person I talked to brought it up to me, and I was like, okay. I was like, I'll tell you what I think. And then, Austin, here's the thing. Going off of, like, we're talking about that big films could be released through on demand and stuff like that. Here's my opinion on it. I'm not sure if we'll, I mean, we might, I could be completely wrong. I mean, I think we'll end up getting bigger films on video on demand. I think it's a good place for more art house type films. And like, for example, let's just like, What's a big film that, let's like, say Whiplash. I'm going to give Whiplash as an example.
Well, Snowpiercer is the other recent example that did right? Earlier in the year, they did day and date, mainly because, you know, we talked about this on a previous show, they just didn't have the money to do two rounds of promotion.
Yeah.
You know, so they did one big push. And so
that
I think that's definitely, based on Snowpiercer and now The Interview, like any film under, I don't know what the floor is at this point, but I don't know, if you're under a $10 million film, you're probably just going to have one big push for like public awareness, public, you know, people caring about the film. And you'll see it in like these limited art house, you know, distributions in the theaters.
Yeah.
And then it'll be available day and date on these other digital services. Now, the question with The Interview and Sony and kind of the big studios is like, well, how big a film do you risk this on? You know, without bringing in like all the news media and the you know, freedom of speech things that were connected to the whole debate. You know, would you put out what would be like a $30-40 million comedy film in that ballpark? You know, like it doesn't seem like you would do Avatar 2 this way.
No, right?
I mean,
yeah, and going off
random massive film.
Yeah, like going off this, I think you're talking about what the ceiling is. I feel The Interview reportedly cost $44 million to. That's the production budget, $44 million. Snowpiercer was right. $40 million. So that's kind of the area that we're looking at, I guess. I think for the smaller films that say that won't get played at an Alabama theater or won't get played at a Kansas theater, it could be a good place for those type films to go.
The only real group that's against this, right, and the whole reason that this process has been slow, and this will tie in well to our next topic, right, is that the only people who are really defending this old system are the theaters. Like, the studios have no reason to do two rounds of promotion. You know what I mean? They want to, like, get in, get out, be done with this thing. You know, spend one round on marketing, and the only reason they haven't is because these theaters, these big theater chains, are threatening them and saying, we won't take your next film if you push us around like this, or whatever nonsense, you know. But the big thing from a consumer standpoint, from a person who just wants to watch movies, you know, The Interview came out, I wanted to see it, and it's around the Christmas holidays. I am not, you know, we've talked about this. Small kid. My wife and I are not going to just go out on, you know, December 26th or December 27th to see a 10 o'clock screening of The Interview after our child's gone to sleep.
Yeah.
But because it's available on a streaming service, you know, we download it and start watching it like 10:30 at night, and we giggle like small, you know, high school students because we're like, ooh, we're staying up late. We're watching a movie, you know?
Yeah.
It's just like, I'm consuming the film, and some of the debate of the articles is like, you know, Sony is, they're not making, you know, in that particular example of two people who want to see the film, right? They're not making the, like, two movie tickets that they would have made. They're only getting the one rental.
Yeah.
But they don't split it with the theater. Basically, like, the economics are not that bad. And the key for me is, like, I get to see more films. Like, it's basically, like, if it had only been in theaters, there's maybe a 50-50 chance I would have found time to go see it. And the chance of me going to see it with my wife, like finding a time for that to happen, almost, not, I mean, you know, whatever that says. For the two of us to go see a film is an ordeal.
Yeah.
Like, it is a big deal in a theater, but if we can stream it, we'll watch it. And so that's like, it's money they wouldn't otherwise have, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
No, and it's money that they wouldn't have gotten from us any other way.
Yeah, and going off the, because there, to me, an example, you're talking about the theaters getting mad. I remember a few years ago, some people might forget this film, but it was a movie called Tower Heist with Eddie Murphy and Ben Stiller. And at the time, Universal planned on releasing it on video on demand through Comcast three weeks after it was going to be premiered in the U.S., and theaters just, like, were upset completely. And they were like, we won't, like you said, we won't release the film, or we won't release your next films if you do this to harm our tickets. Because it's going to harm our ticket sales. And we don't, and also, too, they were afraid that it would inspire more films to do the same thing. So, like, it's been a constant fight.
Right, and that does transition really well to this next topic, which is you know, the TV streaming services and all the conflict going on around cable.
Yeah.
Because it's the exact same thing of like, when will, you know, the dam finally give way? Because that they know this, right? They know that once once you go to day and date release, then yeah, that will affect ticket sales. And once we break cable, you know, once the channels become unbundled, like seriously unbundled to where people can choose, then yeah, like the economics change significantly for those players in the market. But like, it's going to happen. And that's like the big announcement, a week or two ago, is this Dish streaming service of Sling, where you can get $20 a month. You can get it through the internet. So it's like the first time that you can get ESPN. You know, we've talked about it. You get a bunch of other channels, you know, Discovery, TNT, TBS, CNN. But the key, Cartoon Network. But you get ESPN without a cable package for $20 a month.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked about it on the previous show when HBO announced that they were going to do streaming, like streaming without a cable package. CBS announced their service. I mean, this is it. I mean, there's no going back from this point, because now, I mean, so there's all the old, you know, our parents or grandparents or whatever, they're not going to do this, right? They're not going to get $20 a month internet service to do, like, why change for them, right?
Yeah.
But the thing that's in some of these articles is the executives of these stations or the cable companies, things are realizing, like, we're not just talking about cord cutters. They're talking about people who are no cord. Like, they've never had cable, never will get cable.
Yeah.
You know? And so they're now trying to chase after those people with this low end. But what are you going to see? I mean, definitely. Like, it's never going to go. I mean, they do have, like, a lot of control over this stuff, right? But, I mean, think about how the floor has now changed for what people are willing to pay. And, like, if you had Comcast right now and you were paying $200 a month, and you really thought about it, you're like, I really just want ESPN for football. That, you know, like, I'm that guy. Like, there's no way that I would sign up for a full Comcast package if I could get this service and it's any good. It's not available yet.
Yeah.
Probably by the time this podcast goes up, it'll be available. But
probably.
I mean, $20 a month, that is night and day between the prices that have been run up on the cable side. And so, this is the year of, like, just the decline of the massive, the sharp decline. Maybe, you know, it's not going to disappear by any means, but cable is substantially hurt.
Yeah, we'll see it. Well, I mean, because at the beginning of last year, this wasn't really that present. Like, it was,
right.
I mean, it was, Hulu was there, yeah, and then you had things like Netflix and whatever, but you weren't seeing, like, you're talking this package deal that Dish is offering with, I mean, the big channels are ESPN and the sports channels that could. That's why a lot of people will watch television. I mean, like, my roommates, for one, some of them didn't have cable before we moved out here, and we got cable because they're just like, we usually just stream stuff and we would watch, like, sports games somewhere else. Like you said, it's breaking away to where you're not just paying for this one package that could be in the hundreds of dollars depending on what you're getting. Now you get the same thing for like $20 to $30 a month and still have the same exact quality and actually pick and choose what you can watch at what time, probably.
This is the big part of this that I think we'll talk about more throughout the year and it will become more apparent as we go. But I mean, just think about, like, even though this service is not yet available and we don't know how many people will sign up, and I think there are all sorts of restrictions on the amount of people they're going to allow to jump onto this, right, to try and basically throttle it from becoming too popular.
Yeah.
But if you're not one of these networks, right, or stations that's on this list, like if you, like A&E is not on this list, AMC is not on this list.
Yeah.
You know, you can go down a list of some of these stations, some of these channels that have made really big plays for original content, and we've talked about it. I mean, you know, they have all the other deals where they can release it on Hulu and they can release it on Netflix, and they can try and build a following in a way, like, outside of, you know, a show can build a following outside of the channel, but they get the majority of their money from these cable deals. And if cable takes a much steeper nosedive and you're not getting a little bit of money coming back from something like this Dish streaming service, like, it's going to be really interesting to see what all these different shows that people have come to love, what they do to try and still make the kind of, like, high dollar, big production, you know, bets, basically, you know, because the money is getting drained out a little bit here, you know, because people are kind of sick of paying so much, and it's going to be interesting to see how it changes, you know, how it changes the quote unquote golden age of television, you know.
Yeah, it will, because we're looking at this past weekend. When you guys listen to it, it'll be a little bit later. But we had the Golden Globes, and a lot of the nominees were from going off from streaming shows, like through Netflix and through Amazon. And Amazon picked up the big win of the night. They won Best Original or Best Comedy of the Year and Best Supporting or Best Actor in Leading or Best Leading Actor in a Comedy. That kind of, to me, shows a change.
Yeah, I mean, the other big news for Amazon is they picked up that Woody Allen.
Yeah, they picked up Woody Allen.
And his press release was classic. you know, classic Woody Allen.
Yeah.
But we'll put it in the show notes. I won't misquote it. But
I'll misquote it. He was like, it was almost like, I don't know why they're letting me do this. Cause like, yeah. Like, cause Woody Allen is like one of the, he still types his movies on a typewriter. Like Woody Allen was the weirdest choice to me that Amazon would get. Like I'm shocked he said yes. I'm honestly shocked that Woody Allen said yes.
We don't know the details of the deal, but I mean, I'm curious to see if Amazon has, you know, because they've had several rounds of these pilot seasons where they've let everybody vote and they've tried to kind of just let it be like this democratic thing of, well, let's see what people like and we'll spread our bets, basically. We'll make 10 different pilots and, you know, they were trying to kind of upend the Hollywood TV model by letting people vote. That was really the only difference. They were making a scattershot of pilots just like everybody else, and a lot of them were low budget.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, like, it seems like this might be their move towards more of a Netflix model of we're going to bet on big name, marquee names. I guess that's redundant. Big names, marquee names. They're going to bring in people who are recognizable that they can promote and win awards and make a run at, you know, this like quality over quantity, basically, you know.
I didn't know this. Steven Soderbergh has a series through Amazon coming out this year.
Oh, wow. I hadn't heard that. I
had no idea. It says three new series are coming out, including Soderbergh's and then another one that's Woody Allen. Like, this is...
Yeah, it is a great time to be a well-known, well-established name. You know what I mean? Like, if you're Adam Sandler, Woody Allen, Steven Soderbergh, you know, Kevin Spacey, whatever, you can go to these streaming services and they will just drool and throw millions. And, you know, with good reason, you're gonna bring in viewers.
Because the other thing, too, people like Woody and Soderbergh, you're not just bringing in the big name directors because they're so big. You'll end up bringing big stars in. Like,
oh, definitely.
Like, I mean, like Woody Allen's like past few movies have starred Emma Stone, Colin Firth, Cate Blanchett, like Owen Wilson. Like, they've starred pretty big people, and there are a lot of people who are like just dying to work with Woody Allen.
Yeah,
this just it gives. And he'll still make his one movie a year thing, too, with this. And the thing is about this guy, he's like in his 80s. Is he 80? He's 79.
Yeah, we looked it up the other day because, you know, we were on Christmas break. And I was like, you know, this guy is still making a film a year. And, you know, the other guy, actually, the other guy we were looking up, too, was Clint Eastwood.
Clint Eastwood. I mean,
both of them.
Who made two movies
are still making,
year.
Like, two movies or a movie a year. And you're talking about... It's like, my goodness, I feel tired and I'm, you know, hitting up on 30. I have no idea if, you know, there's no way I'm going to be making two films a year at 83 or whatever.
Yeah, or making a TV show and a film. And then also, too, Woody, he wrote a Broadway musical as well this past year.
Wow.
So it's like...
That is just amazing. Consistency of output is just... Really, really impressive.
It's insane. It's just like what are they eating? Like, what are they doing to do this amount of stuff?
I don't know. I'm gonna shake up the show notes here a little bit, but You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of these late night guys. You like that for a segue? I mean, basically,
okay.
You like that? Come on, we're bringing it forward. I mean, it feels like they're on that like treadmill of these guys that do a show four nights a week or whatever. You know, it's like you have to be hustling every day, you know, to be writing, directing, moving forward on so many projects. It's such a senior, and I mean that in the nice way, senior age. I mean, it's just impressive. It really, really impressive.
It really is. But yeah, so going off the late night stuff that you're referencing, this past year we saw a lot of shakeups in the late night television shows. We had Jay Leno left around, I think, February, around the Winter Olympics, and Jimmy Fallon took over, and then Letterman decides to retire. And then Stephen Colbert will be his replacement this coming year. Craig Ferguson steps down around the same time Letterman decides to retire. And then James, I don't want to pronounce his name wrong. I think it's Corbin.
People are going to have a hard time differentiating between Colbert.
James Corden. Corden. So Corden.
All right.
So Corden, I knew him. I didn't see the play, but I remember watching the Tonys one year because he's from England. He did a play called One Man, Two Governors. And it was...
Two Governors.
It was at the Tonys, and he won Best Actor in, like, 2012. And he beat out, like, some big... He beat out James Earl Jones, Frank Langella, John Lithgow, and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Wow.
This dude won, like, one Best Actor out of those guys. He was in Into the Woods recently, that came out this December or this Christmas. He was in that film. All of a sudden, they felt like he's kind of come out of nowhere, but he's kind of just been doing a lot of different things. But yeah, it's an interesting shakeup because going back to Fallon, Leno was this kind of old. I don't mean it in a bad way, but an older. He was the it's weird to say. He was like the uncle you listen to, if that makes sense.
No, that's a good way to put it.
And then Fallon comes in.
Letterman was the dirty uncle you didn't want to listen
to. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it was. Letterman just has this like kind of sarcastic demeanor that is much different than Leno. And
skeezy lawsuit vibe is how I would put it. But.
Anyway, so Fallon comes in, and Fallon he really uses social media and like we're talking about in the pre-show was that like. We might not have watched like full episodes of the Tonight Show now, but we always see those skits or like games that he does with like his guest. Like he did the big one that I just looked at because I looked at his YouTube channel views. His lip sync battle with Emma Stone has like 40 million views, and then he has a bunch in the 30 million range as well. And it's just like nowadays, it's like I can literally go almost every week now, sometimes multiple times a week. When you're looking at like Facebook or Twitter, and you look at the news feed, there's always a new Fallon bit that happened the night before.
Let's go ahead and say it right now. Like that is impressive.
Yeah.
You know, it may not be like, the money may not be there on YouTube right now to necessarily like, you know, make up for clearly the money is on the TV side of it, right? I mean, the ads that play during the broadcast are way more valuable than the streaming YouTube ads that probably pop up, right?
Yeah.
But just like for anyone to have that level of like, you know, exposure into like the mass culture like that.
Yeah.
You know, like everyone is desperately fighting for attention, right? And to just have it over and over and be so good at it. For it to be so seamless,
yeah.
I mean, that is definitely you have to respect him on that alone because you know think about all the shows and all the weekly things and I mean even Last Week Tonight and The Daily Show and The Colbert Report when it was on and you know Saturday Night Live, all these things are all trying to do the same thing. They want you to share, you know, they want you to share these skits so people can like. Eventually want to come back and watch the broadcast, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe watch it later streaming like a full episode, I guess. I don't know. But
yeah.
I mean, he is just, his views are insane on YouTube. And it's more, I think the numbers are more than his broadcast. You know what I mean? It's just, it's amazing.
Well, it's like a week ago, I remember this, it was just an interview. This is an interview that just turned to gold. It was Jimmy Fallon interviewing Nicole Kidman. And it's like a 9-minute interview. Has 19.5 million views in 1 week.
Oh my goodness. That is amazing.
And it's, and it was just and the thing is, it was just an interview. It was comedic gold. Because what it was is that, have you watched this at all? Or do you know what I'm talking about?
No, but I would love to hear you recount it, Brandon.
Well, basically what it is Nicole Kidman talks about how she thought she went on a date with Jimmy Fallon. And Jimmy Fallon didn't know it was a date. And so she comes to his apartment. This is actually a true story. She comes to his apartment. He's like wearing like a baseball cap and like sweatpants and playing a video game. And she just sits, down and like they talk about nothing. And it's like apparently so awkward. And she's just thinking, maybe he's not into me.
That is funny.
It's the thing about Fallon that's so cool to watch is that he's really good with talking. Like he's friends with these people that he's interviewing.
Yeah.
And
he's very likable.
He's very likable. He always, like, he, it's so fun to see him crack up at stuff. It's like the big thing that he was, like, bad at on SNL, he would always crack up during skits.
Well, but that, to me, that was the best, you know.
It was
the classic SNL skits.
Yeah.
He's, like, got the drumsticks in front of his face trying to look like he's not laughing. But you know, to me, it's like he represents, like, the everyman. He represents like us in that moment. Like we would be dying in that moment. And so to see him fight it is hilarious. I thought it was hilarious. I know a lot of people are like, he's breaking character, blah, blah, blah. But like him and Will Ferrell especially, you know, because Will Ferrell would push him off script and to the max. And watching him break and interact with people, like you said, it's gold. It's gold.
It's gold. I mean, it's just insane of... like in a short amount of time, because I remember when he came out, because I'd watched him on late night a lot and loved him. Like I loved his thank you note bits and all this stuff. And what we talked about in the pre-show was like he really didn't change his structure one bit. Like he didn't. That was the big thing with Conan, was that when Conan came on, Conan had to almost like restructure all of his stuff, like all of his humor, all of his jokes. Fallon didn't do any of that. Fallon just came in with the same bits, the same way of using the internet, and just like, because the thing is, when you look at the videos on YouTube, the only way you can tell that it's a different show is by the set they're sitting on. It feels the exact same. And so it's just he didn't like compromise his views or compromise his humor. He just carried the same thing. And I remember people at the time who had never ever watched him. And when Leno went off, like a lot of people that were older that didn't watch Fallon or whatever, they watched Leno. Not everyone was like this, but a lot of people were like, Fallon's really funny. I didn't know how funny he was. I didn't think he'd do that well. And a lot of people were like waiting for that time for like the drop, like the he came on for a week, he'll peak and he'll go down. Thing is, he never went down in ratings. He's been solid the entire time. He knows how to use this culture to help help his show. He's very in tune with what the people like and what they think are funny.
He gives the people what they want.
He gives people what they want. Exactly. And that's actually a good segue.
A poor rendition of an SNL line.
Now, actually, that's a good segue into what we're going to talk about next.
Ooh.
And we're going to talk about the Marvel DC stuff that happened this year.
How is that a segue?
This is going to be my segue. This is how Marvel introduced their films.
Oh, you're talking about how savvy this is. Yeah, I'm with you.
How savvy it was. Marvel introduced, what they did was they rented out, or they took the Disney's theater, El Capitan or whatever theater on Hollywood Boulevard in LA for a quote-unquote secret event for Marvel fans. People show up. The place is packed. And it's them announcing their Phase 3 lineup. So basically till like 2020 or whatever. And they release all of it. People are like tweeting it. It's like, here's what we have. Here's Guardians of Galaxy 2. And they have the director come on, like, via satellite and do an interview for it, and they announce, like, Chadwick Boseman as Black Panther, and then next thing you know, Robert Downey Jr. comes out and Chris Evans come out, and it's the announcement of the Civil War for Captain America 3, and it's, like, this big, huge spectacle. And then a few weeks before, DC announced their lineup until 2021, and they did it in, like, a shareholders meeting in New York and through a press release.
Little, yeah, there, you know, yeah, that's, you would want to take that back if you're the DC guys.
Yeah,
you know, you're just like, we just got burned pretty bad.
Yeah, and the thing is, I have no, like, I want to see DC succeed. I really want to see Ben Affleck as Batman. People will, like, probably hate me for that, but I want to see what he can do. And I want to see the films, but I just feel right now, Marvel at Disney with Kevin Feige, they know what the audience... Like, Guardians of the Galaxy, this obscure comic book in the past, was released as a movie this year. People thought it would flop. And the next thing you know, it's like one of the biggest hits of the year. And to me, this proves Marvel can literally do no wrong right now. They can release these obscure...
Well, but let's be do no wrong is a little bit carte blanche for them. I mean, okay. there's a great John August and Craig Mazin and what's their script notes? Yeah. There's a great script notes episode where they interview the writer of that.
Yeah.
And how she went through this extremely long and arduous writing process through this Marvel writing program that actually doesn't exist anymore, I don't think. But, I mean, apparently, like, they were talking through it, and it's like the deal, you know, the deal was basically, like, they would pay for her, you know, it was a group of several other writers, and they would pay them, like, a pretty low salary to basically have an opportunity to learn and take a stab at whatever property within the Marvel Universe they wanted.
Yeah.
And so she's the one that picked that. I mean, I think they were able to put a list together, and then they were kind of like, this is what I want, and then, you know, yes or no. And they're like, yeah, go for it. So, I mean, listening through that, I mean, do no wrong. Like, I mean, what? It sounds like, I think she did draft after draft after, yeah, after draft after draft. I mean, like, they spent forever on that. So it was definitely not just like they picked an old comic book and magic fell out of the stars.
No.
You know, I mean, they've earned it.
Oh, no, I agree. But here's what I mean by do no wrong. I mean, they can release a movie of an obscure superhero, and they can essentially make them money. Like, that's what I mean. It's like people...
Buckets of money.
Buckets of money. Like, it showed that they could tell it. Like, basically, they showed you didn't have to be... And they did it with Iron Man, too, when it first came out. Iron Man was, like, kind of a second-tier superhero. And now he's, like, everyone's favorite, almost. Like, they took...
Well, he's not put me in that camp.
He's one of the favorites of many people. I'll say that. Because...
Yeah.
You didn't have to bank on Spider-Man, X-Men, all these bigger superheroes. You could actually take these smaller heroes that we don't really know, that aren't really household names, I guess, and then make them superstars, essentially, in the film world. And Guardians was just another way of showing we could take even, like, not the second tier, but, like, the third tier people you've never even heard of and release those movies and make a good movie out of it and show there's an audience here. Like, they're kind of like what Pixar was when Pixar first came around, how Pixar could just release hit after hit after hit for, like...
Yeah, and then... Well, yeah, I mean, I would split them off a little bit. Just, I mean, you know, because they have created... I think a key with Pixar is they've created new IP. You know, they've written new characters, new worlds.
Yeah.
New technology to make the films. I mean, you know, Pixar is impressive on another level for me personally as a nerd. But Marvel, like, I mean, I'll tell you, I'm one of those people that's a little, and I'm not alone in this. You know, I'm a little burned out with all the superhero.
Yeah.
You know, they keep running ads for whatever the next Avengers mayhem, 2. Blow everything up, thing. And I'm just like, you know, I might watch it if it's on Netflix for free and I'm really bored or something like, you know, on it. Or I may go see it in theater. I don't know. Like, but it's like a begrudging thing. I'll tell you what I liked about Guardians of the Galaxy. Not to make this like a little mini review thing, but like to me it felt a little bit like an anti, you know, this like anti superhero movie a little bit, where they were able to play with the conventions in a way that, like, because the characters were not these established figures.
Yeah.
In the universe and in the previous films, they were these new things. Like, they were able to do like some pretty ridiculous, like, kind of out of the box things compared to what we're normally seeing in, you know, Iron Man 14 or whatever movie we're up to. And it was just a lot of, you know, because there was a lot of sarcasm, a lot of you know, just a lot of things that were like, you know, the jokes I felt like had a lot more depth and they could go a lot more places. Then it seems like they're able to go with some of these big, you know, Superman, even Batman and, you know, these other films where it's like, because they've made so many and they've established this world so tightly, they're pretty constrained, whereas Guardians of the Galaxy felt like this, a little bit like fresh air, where they could really kind of like, you know, there's a whole new world, a whole new group of people, and we can introduce them however we want to. Uh-huh. And, you know, kind of go and neuter. I mean, they had a freaking tree in there, you know what I mean? Like. Yeah. Not to say that that's like the greatest thing ever, but like there was some great little humor between all the different characters that we haven't seen between the big green guy and the iron suit dude, and you know, I'm kidding, I know their names, but like some of the people connected to the Avengers movie, like I do not know, like what is there, Nighthawk or some guy that like shoots arrows, like some of these characters to
Hawkeye.
Me, Hawkeye. Okay, I'm trying to make enemies here for some unknown reason, but like some of these characters are just like, why? Like, you clearly have way better superheroes in the movies, like the dude in the huge iron suit or the guy that can turn into a Hulk and go bananas, and then you just have a dude that can fly around and shoot arrows. Like, I don't know. I'm trying to stir the pot just a little bit, but
it wouldn't be a show if you didn't.
I know. I'm doing. You know who really needs to be in this moment, and I'm gonna shout out so he comes on to the next episode. We really need Mason here. I need Mason here to put me on the path of righteousness.
Of course you do.
I'm just kidding.
Marvel's made some good decisions in how they've handled stuff. DC still undetermined. We still are not sure. I'm interested in seeing what they do. They've announced like the Suicide Squad's cast. With like Will Smith, and Jared Leto as the Joker, which will be interesting.
That'll be good.
Yeah, they had Tom Hardy, but Tom Hardy actually backed out today, as of today, January 15th.
Well, he had already played Bane.
Yeah, but it's different universes.
Wait a minute. What are you talking about? Different universes? It's the same. Am I wrong? Is this not Batman? You're saying just they're making it because it's no longer Nolan, it's going to be a different Batman universe or something?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what I mean by that. Two different.
The tone in my voice indicates my excitement over the alternate Batman universes. Just let Nolan, let him rest for a little bit. Nolan, some people have questions about the last film, you know, like as far as it wasn't as good as the others or whatever, but like That was a kind of high point, you know? Like, let those rest for a little bit. Let them be. Let people buy up, like, collector's Blu-ray sets, you know? And, like, put them in the vault or whatever the Disney stuff does. And then maybe, like, you know, in 5 years or something. Like, why do we desperately need... I do want to see Ben Affleck as Batman just because everybody hates him so bad. I'm ready for it. But, you know, I don't know. This is my begrudging, like, let's do some... I know why they're popular. We've said this before. I'm getting off the rails here. They're popular overseas. They're popular in these other countries where, you know, it's difficult.
They're popular
here,
too.
No, they are. But, like, large portions of Hollywood's revenue come from overseas now, and so they're making these gargantuan CGI monstrosities that do well in China and these foreign markets, you know, because in China in particular, there's a cap on how many films they can release in China per year to protect the Chinese film industry. And so they want to send the biggest, craziest American films, you know, in, so they're not making these you know, they're not making a lot of Michael Claytons, you know, not to celebrate a one film in particular, but, you know.